This infinite resource of creativity will shrink to nothing in the face of an infinite need for more. And we have to get past that and say, I don't want infinity. I am firing the New York Times. It's not on my agenda. It does not exist for me. I am not writing to make them happy. Instead, there's 1,000 people I seek to serve. That's enough. If I change the life of 1,000 people with my creative work, it's enough.
I'm so glad you're here. That was the incomparable Seth Godin, whose new book, This Is Marketing, You Can't Be Seen Until You Learn to See, just hit number one on the Wall Street Journal list and was also an immediate New York Times bestseller. But Seth could care less, and he wants that same freedom for you. It's an interesting perspective from a guy who's previously written 18 international bestsellers and has a daily blog readership of over 1 million people. You may have been expecting Dave Eggers to be with us today, as was scheduled, but Obama happened. So we'll have to wait for Dave, who is traveling with and interviewing our beloved President Obama. I guess that's a good excuse, even though Seth Godin. I'm so happy that Samantha Bennett, bestselling author of Get It Done and Start Right Where You Are, and my co-conspirator over in the Beautiful Writers Group, I'm so happy she was free today. Sam and Seth are big admirers of each other's work, and you guys know how much I love matchmaking and putting people together who adore each other, but who haven't yet met. Like when Glennon Doyle came on to guest co-host with her idol, Anne Lamott. Or putting Terry McMillan and Danny Shapiro, both great novelists and teachers, together. Or the time Robert McKee came on and guest co-hosted with one of his literary idols, Dean Koontz. Yeah, this was that kind of joyful event for me. So much so that I mostly just wanted to sit and listen to the two of them. Hashtag best job ever. Okay, in light of that, less feels like more today. So let's get this marketing book love party started. Welcome.
Okay, so I want to plunge right in here because I want to talk about people who are resistant to marketing and for what seems to me to be the issues of sort of false values, the false values of poverty or modesty or selflessness or, you know, like, oh, I can't possibly sully my hands with that dirty, dirty sales and marketing. This weird sort of moral high ground that creative people and artistic people and spiritual development and personal development people often, I think, hide out in. And you talk about authenticity and showing up as a professional, but it also strikes me that if you've got something that you just love to do, then that's a hobby. And that's great. And everybody should have hobbies. Everybody should have two. They're beautiful. Right? But if you've got something that you really feel like is going to help people, then you need to get behind the marketing. You need to start telling the story about it to say like, oh, I've got this work, but I don't want to do the sales and marketing. It's like, well, I want children, but only when they're quiet and well-behaved. It's like being an aunt, you know? You've got to be a good parent to your child, to your thing, whatever your thing is, and fulfill your obligation on getting it out there.
There's so much good stuff in what you just said. We could talk about it the whole time. I need to decode parts of it, so let's start there. If somebody buys something from you for $10, the only reason they are doing it is because they think it's worth $15.
Oh.
They thought it was worth $5, they wouldn't buy it. Mm-hmm. So they think it's worth $15 and you're offering it to them for $10. You're giving them $5 worth of value for free. And if you refuse to sell it to them, you're stealing from them. And if we look at our work, understanding that what marketers actually do, good marketers, real marketers, marketers that deserve the word marketer. What we do is we make things better by making better things. What we do is show up in front of people who are stuck, who are afraid, who are resistant, who are insecure, who don't know. And we help them get to where they want to go. If you view it that way, more like you are a lifeguard or a teacher, I think you can get past the first line of offense, the first line of, I don't want to do that because I don't want to be a used car salesman. The thing about used car salesmen, the kind that we're thinking about, we don't like them because after we buy the car, we regret it. But I would argue that very few people who read Middlemarch regretted it. Very few people who listened to Herbie Hancock with, you know, Watermelon Man or whatever classic piece he did regretted it. So if they're not going to regret it, then your work of bringing it to them is a generous act. And the second half, because your listeners are smart and they already knew that part, is this. If you commit to bringing work to people in such a way that they trust you, take a leap, and seek more value, and you fail, that sucks. Now it's on you. That's the main reason why creatives don't want to do what they think of as besmirching themselves with sales and marketing, because they don't want to get on the hook of saying, I'm making things better by making better things. Because if you're really saying that, it better be a better thing. So I get your fear. I feel your fear. I've had your fear. You cannot make that fear go away, but you can dance with it.
Oh, so good. I love the line in the new book about how real marketing isn't about making noise or racking up clicks and tweets. It's about connection and empathy and generosity and making a difference. This really feels to me, Seth, you know, as somebody who's followed you for many years, interviewed you before years ago, it feels like the culmination of everything you've ever told us. Does it feel like that to you?
Well, yeah, when I sat with my publisher, and I'm a hypocrite, I've quit the book publishing world many times.
Right.
He said, Adrian's the guy who named the book. The original title was Make Things Better by Making Better Things. Mm. He said, look, you've been doing this for 30 years and you've seen this revolution come. You described it. You mapped it out for us. And it's being taken away by bottom fishers, being taken away by scammers. And you can reclaim it. And he said, so let's just own that and call it this. This thing. This is it. Not
this is
thing,
it.
This. And the thing that puts you on the hook but also lets you off the hook in the book is my assertion that all important, all useful marketing does not seek to serve everyone. It seeks to serve the smallest viable audience. And the thing about smallest viable audience, the good news is, for a writer, that's totally doable. Because the best-selling book in America this year will not be purchased by 99% of the population. That's the number one bestseller, will not be purchased by 99%. So smallest is easy for us. The thing The fearful part is, what if you claim your tiny audience? My audience is stay-at-home moms in Seattle who have 9-year-olds, right?
Yeah.
If you claim them and you don't please them, that is really scary. Because now you're triple on the hook. And so we fear, as writers, but as marketers as well, owning something specific, because it feels so much safer to own something general.
So good. I loved how you talked in the book about Hamilton. As big of a show as it's been and as popular as the book and all of the ancillary products have been, we're only talking about a couple hundred thousand, right? And yet it's monster for the people who love it.
Right. And so if you're going to bother being a creative, I hope, even if you live in LA, you can acknowledge that the mass market is not only gone, but it wasn't for you all along. That what it takes to reach the mass market is to make the Beverly Hillbillies. And, you know, you don't hear a lot about the people who made the Beverly Hillbillies because they're not that proud of it. The only thing it was popular. Not that it was important. So if you're going to do this horrible, back-breaking, emotional work, first acknowledge you're lucky you don't have to dig a ditch. Acknowledge that you're lucky that you live in a place where you're not sitting outside in 100-degree weather all day.
Amen.
If you're going to do this, go through the pain and the suffering, at least make something you're proud of.
I love this. And I love talking to super specific people. And I hear from people sometimes like, oh, you know, email marketing is dead. Email marketing doesn't work. And I'm like, yeah, no, you're just not doing it right. It totally works. But it doesn't work if you're super general or super annoying or aren't telling compelling stories to people who really want to hear them. And Seth, I'm so curious about your answer to this because I feel like emails have a smell. I've got a very large and responsive list and I love them and they write me back and it's a beautiful dialogue. And they're very, you know, they click when I'm selling them something. They click when I'm showing them somebody else's work. But when I send them something that's just super heartfelt, like middle of the night, I had to wake up and write this to you, my open rate skyrockets. And I'm like, how do they know? How can they tell just by looking at the subject line that this email has particular love in it? I feel like they can smell it.
Yeah, that's a great question. First, you mentioned something earlier that I didn't address yet, which is authenticity. Mm. With very few exceptions, and I'm about to add you to the list, authenticity doesn't matter. Authenticity is overrated. Authenticity is not important. When we think about all the things we engage in and buy, you know, I had my car serviced this morning. And if Tom had said to me when I showed up for my appointment, you know, I just don't really feel like changing the oil in your car today. I would have said, well, you're being very authentic, but I'm never coming back here again because I just want you to be a professional. You made a promise, show up and keep the promise. Mm. And there are a few examples on the internet of people doing the authentic theater thing where I wrote this in the middle of the night and this is how I really feel right now. But there are very, very few people who can do that and make a living at it. And it is a very specific place to be, that we don't want to know how Raymond Carver felt when he was writing one of his novels. We don't want to know if Stephen King is actually afraid on page 484. That's not the point. You're there as a professional. Now, what I will tell you as someone who has written and delivered more than 8,000 emails is I can smell it before I send it. That if you are writing naturally and comfortably and in service, your word choices are different. But if you feel cornered or you need to make your numbers work or you're backing into something, I can feel that as a writer. So a business I've been paying attention to recently and we talked about in the marketing seminar is a company called Garagiste. And here's how it works. You give them your credit card and they set up a corner of their warehouse in Oregon for you. And then three or four times a week, they send you a beautifully written email about some wine that the owner has found in his travels. And if you want one, two, three, four, five bottles, you click a button and they add it to your case. And then two or three times a year, they ship you what's been collected in that corner all at once. And the magic of the writing is this. He is not trying to find buyers for his wine. He is trying to find wine for his buyers. And that posture is super different.
Oh, that's right? Nice.
It's a telegram.
That feels good.
It's a telegram from Southern France. Hey, Bob, guess what I found for you? You want some? That feels totally different than want to buy the wine I got to sell. And if you do the math, let's say there's all, I don't even drink wine. I'm just buying this for the family. But let's say there's, he's got 5,000 people in corners of his warehouse, just 5,000. To be able to go to a vineyard owner and say, you got 2,500 bottles left and you want $30 a bottle, I'll buy all of it for half that. The vineyard owner is thrilled. They get the cash right away. He's thrilled because he has something no one else has. And the buyer is thrilled because by buying on their behalf, he actually created enormous amounts of value. Where this will fall apart is if he decides to build an infinitely scaled public company. But until he gets hooked on infinity, it's great because that's the magic of this revolution we live in where we are connected to people we seek to be connected to. Right? So Kevin Kelly, founding editor of Wired Magazine, Kevin sent me an email 4 days ago saying, you know, me and a couple people have been working on this for a couple of years and it came out today. You want it? I made it for you. And it's like instant yes. Of course.
For sure.
Because you're
for
not going to break the bond just so you can make $4 from me. Mm-hmm. And that mindset of sufficiency translates our work completely differently because everyone gets the same keyboard. Everyone gets the same tools. So what's missing is, do you feel sufficient? Or do you feel like you're scamming people?
Yeah, it's a mindset. You said a word in that description that just triggered a memory for me, Seth. You did a podcast, I don't know if you remember this, but it was years ago. It was called The Deletionist,
yep.
where you talked about how a telegram announced limited editions of the 1903 Encyclopedia Britannica. I actually have a full set of those. They're leather and gold embossed. I think mine were 1900 or maybe 1910, but with the onion skin pages, they were my favorite things growing up. They still are my favorite possession. But you were talking then about how this was marketing at its absolute finest back then, right? With the telegram announcing this thing. I don't know why that story just stuck with me. Is that sparking anything for you now based on marketing now?
Well, sure, because the telegrams are free now, right? And as a result, people who are selfish think they can send one to anyone they want.
Oh, that's intense.
And so I invented commercial email in 1991 before the World Wide Web.
Mm-hmm.
And from the first day, I acted like every email I sent cost me money. Because it does. The way it costs me money is if I blow it, I never get that trust back. I never get that attention back. So you say to yourself, a million people are going to read this today. At a nickel a pop, that's 50K. Would I pay $50,000 to share this with the world? Because if the answer is no, I shouldn't send it.
I love this. I love looking for the win-win-win-win-win-win-win. Like, might be offering that's like, it's good for me, but it's good for them. And it's good for the parking guy. And it's good for the neighborhood. And it's good for everybody. And also this idea of sufficiency that especially when you are selling something that comes from your creativity is an infinite and infinitely renewable resource, right? You're never going to get to the end of your great ideas. Then we're not making money by exploiting the planet or by exploiting cheap labor. We're exploiting an infinitely renewable resource. And it's meeting the infinitely renewable resource of people who might be interested or money or, I mean, I guess there is a finite amount of money, but we're not going to get to it. So, you know, who cares? So when infinite resource meets infinite resource, there's nothing but generosity. There's no competition.
Unless you need infinity. Because if you need infinity, you're going to be disappointed. And then you're going to cut corners. So I'm fascinated by bestseller lists. I'm fascinated by how some of them work and some of them don't. I'm fascinated by signaling. And mostly, I'm fascinated by how some authors can't get enough of it and how they will not only cheat in their marketing to be on a list, but they will cheat in their writing to be on a list as if it's worth something to be on a list. And to your point, Sam, this infinite resource of creativity will shrink to nothing in the face of an infinite need for more. And we have to get past that and say, I don't want infinity. I am firing the New York Times. It's not on my agenda. It does not exist for me. I am not writing to make them happy. Instead, there's 1,000 people I seek to serve. That's enough. If I change the life of 1,000 people with my creative work, it's enough. Because it is.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I want to switch gears for a second. Setbacks, letdowns, freakouts. You see your goal on the horizon, but it's not happening. It's just out of reach. We all have spent time in this seemingly godforsaken gap where we just are stymied. When you're in it, Seth, how do you best navigate through that gap, either in life or in your art?
Well, there have been two epochs in my creative life. In the first one, I managed to organize for catastrophe in the sense that I set up the stakes to be that if it didn't work, I was dead, right? And that feeling is a magical fuel as long as you're not dead. And so there were years and years when I was right at the edge, when Yo-Yo Dine had 78 or so employees, we would make payroll with 3 hours to spare. Right?
And
it was just me. I was the boss. I couldn't point to anyone but me. And I was living on a very tight line there. And after that day, I made the choice to pick projects where the scale is sufficient that if I fail, I'll still survive.
Nice.
And that's a totally different feeling. And I will tell you honestly, I don't think I've said this out loud before. I miss the old days.
I kind of do too. And I've been talking with my friends about this. That is so amazing you just said that. Because I no longer will stay up all night to meet a deadline. I no longer kill myself. But there's something lost when you're not willing to just put 100% of everything into something. There's some, I don't know if it's an adrenaline thing. I don't know if it's excitement. Because I think my work is better now, but who knows?
You're coming at this a little differently. So let me distinguish it a bit.
Okay.
Because I still will produce at what Vince Lombardi would call 110%. I still cycle super hard. But what I have dropped from my vocabulary is the narrative of, and then it's over. The sentence, this might not work, is really important to me. It is at the core of my creative fuel. That I am willing to do things that might not work. That's really different than saying, this better work.
Which is so setting yourself up to be screwed.
Or paralyzed, right? So that's the first thing. So then in terms of getting stuck and where I'll get stuck, it involves, one, getting the people who trust me to hear the promise I am trying to make, the way I am trying to make it, and holding me to that promise. Not the promise they make up, but the promise I am actually making for them. Because as I've gained a reputation, people sometimes come with wishes that might not match my promise. But if I don't make their wish come true, they're disappointed. And so that's why I won't have coffee with you. Because what I found is people who ordinarily would have earned 45 minutes of my time, at the end of coffee, they are disappointed.
Oh, totally. I so know this. Okay, this brings me to a question I have about Samantha. So Samantha, you gave Samantha a dream cover blurb for her book, Get It Done, where you called it an instant classic, essential reading for anyone who wants to make a ruckus. And I remember when you gave that to Samantha, her publisher called and told her, and we were cheering. And I'm like, oh my God, how did you get that? She's like, I don't even know. So obviously, we don't want any listeners reaching out to you for cover blurbs. That is absolutely what we don't want. And we do get this question from so many of our listeners. What are the best tips for approaching authors for blurbs? Are there any must-don't-dos in your world, or anything really impresses you and makes it a joyful experience for you?
Okay, so to be clear about two things. One, I did not give that blurb to Sam. Sam earned that blurb.
Oh, I love it.
Wrote it down.
I am so not over it to this day. I'm like belling over here. I'm so
The best way to get a great blurb is to write a book as good as Sam's. So if someone thinks that they deserve a great blurb, they should go read Sam's book and honestly figure out if their book is as good as hers. That's number one. Number two.
I'm going to cry.
I have proof that blurbs do not sell books. They don't.
Yep.
So why bother writing them in the first place? I write them because in 1996, Tom Peters wrote a really nice blurb for me. And I realized on that day that I was a writer. And I was a writer before that. Tom just helped me realize it. And so I think blurbs make authors feel better. They don't sell books. So with that said, my advice to an author who's seeking a blurb is don't. Find a different way, because this person you're asking to judge you doesn't know you, doesn't see you, doesn't understand you, and doesn't have the time to be a useful arbiter of whether you're a writer or not. And so, I'm hoping that no one will send me a book to blurb, because I will not do them justice. But I'm also saying that, as I learned from Tom, if a book's worth $40 and it sells for $20, it probably deserves a blurb, because it's worth twice what you paid for it, right? But I don't take the blurbs I've received as serious indications of a work of genius. I take them of, I wrote a book that was good enough that this person who had enough engagement with me felt like we both benefited from honoring the work.
Yeah.
But as the guy who invented the word blurb also wrote the poem Purple Cow, so I have a particular affinity to the idea of blurbs.
Yes.
However, since you brought it up, my expectation, my advice is don't ask for blurbs. Write a better book instead.
And also, I think it's such a signaler, those blurbs. It's in terms of the people like us do things like this. People who like, if you like this person, you might also like this. It's a signaler of our community, of our tribe.
Well, it's not. It is in terms of at the cocktail party, we know you're one of us. But on Amazon and at the bookstore, if you wrote blurbs from people whose names you made up, it would have exactly the same marketing impact.
Well, there's an idea. Thank you for that idea.
So Seth, Linda, and I were having a conversation recently about in terms of things you never get over, like how it is still such a thrill to go into a bookstore and see your book sitting on a shelf. And I'm still waiting to see one of mine in a used bookstore. I feel like if I make it to a garage sale or a used bookstore, that then like I'll be a real writer. But do you share that thrill?
Okay, so a couple of things. First of all, you're doing great if you're not in a used bookstore because it means people are keeping your book.
And true.
When I moved to my old office, when I was a book packager, I used to do complicated books. This was before Amazon. And so what I would do is buy every book on the topic so that I would have a resource. So I did a bunch of trivia games about the Academy Awards. I had every book ever written about the Academy Awards and on and on. So I had 3,000 extra books I had to get rid of. And I thought, oh, great, I'll just call the local store and they'll happily buy all. No one. So I ran an ad on Craigslist. It took 12 different people who got the books for free to get rid of the 3,000 books. Really hard to get rid of used books. Anyway, 2 weeks later, I get an email from a guy. And the subject line is, your secret's safe with me. Well, it turned out that one of the books I gave away had been signed by the author. And this guy had bought his book on Amazon, used, saw that it was inscribed to someone named Seth, guessed that it was me, and sent me a note saying, I won't tell the author that you gave his book away. So the story I'll tell you is, I don't do book signings anymore. I haven't done a book signing since my first book, pretty much 1986. I really, really sprained my ankle. It was almost broken. But a promise is a promise. So I show up on my crutches at the Barnes & Noble to sign Business Rules of Thumb. And about 10 minutes after I get there, someone showed up and they didn't know Godin's First Law of Book Signings because it had never been announced previously till that day. Godin's First Law is, if the author is signing a book in the store and you step within 15 feet of the table, take the book. You don't have to buy it. You could hide it somewhere in the store. But pick up the book, look at the front, look at the back, and then put it back on the table. Not allowed. So, yes, I love seeing my book in stores. I have a long history of going to stores and putting all the covers face out. But I will also tell you that after 500 years, the bookstore is going away. And the thing about bookstores is, unlike art or jewelry or cosmetics, those stores don't sell every single piece of art and every single piece of jewelry. They have a curated selection. Bookstores pretend they sell everything, and that can't last. So I think there is a future for a store that sells 3,000 different titles, each one a superstar. But the idea that there's a bookstore, as soon as Barnes & Noble's leases run out, they're gone. Oh, sorry.
God. No, that's okay. So I have a question. The first time I held my first book in my hands, I looked at it like it was a foreign object, like somebody had just handed me somebody else's baby. Back when you had your very first book in your hands, how did that feel versus today with 19 international bestsellers later? What's the difference?
Well, I wrote Business Rules of Thumb with Chip Conley. And at the time we were together, added up 48 years old, 24 each. And when I got that, it was like, oh, that's nice. But I still remember 3 months later, I got the French edition. And I don't speak French. That book, I don't know what it was about that book. It was magic. So let's fast forward about 20 years. I was giving a seminar in my office to about 80 people. And while I was talking, my agent came in and handed me a piece of paper that said that my book had just hit the New York Times bestseller list. And I had other books hit the list before. And I held a piece of paper in my hand and I paused for a second. And I started to cry. And the reason I started to cry is that I felt nothing. And I realized in that moment that my practice had changed forever and that it wasn't up to the outside world to make me feel like I had done a good job. And that that crutch I had been using, that if I just promoted it hard enough with that feeling of catastrophe around the corner, that I could feel whole, was gone. Couldn't do it ever again. I just knew it in that moment. And now instead, it's practice. And the practice is this page I just wrote. Can I put my name on it? This book I just laid out. Can I put my name on it? And then I'm done. And then I'm done. It's, you know, this is marketing. Had an amazing week. We went to number one on the Wall Street Journal business list.
You broke Amazon.
Times list. Broke Amazon. That's all a nice thing to be able to say about the execution of the plan. It is a testament to showing up for 30 years, but it gave me no joy. The joy happened months ago when I thought about what's the practice here? How am I going to push myself to a place of discomfort? And then I've left the market itself behind. I don't care how many, and my publisher knows this, I don't care how many copies it sells. That's not the work.
Wow. Sam, what about you? Same question. What was it like the first time you held your book in your hands?
It was definitely out of body and slightly dissociative. Yeah, like, wait, what? What? And definitely when the Korean copy, the Korean version of Get It Done is like the most beautiful book I've ever seen. I'm like, can the Koreans do all my books? Because this is gorgeous. And the weird one came last winter when I got a box and I opened it up and it's the hard copy of Get It Done. And I open it and I go, what? 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 And Luke says, honey, are you okay? I've never seen you have this look on your face before. And I said, I've never had this look on my face before. Get It Done was not published in hardcover. I don't know what this is. And what had happened, of course, was that Barnes & Noble had decided to buy the hardcover rights and publish it and put it on their Inspiration and Motivation for January table, which was, you know, great. I didn't even know that kind of thing happened. And it's so typical of publishing that they didn't tell me about it. They just do these things.
Love it.
But that was the trippiest. That was the trippiest.
I have a question, Seth, for you about teaching. Some of our greatest writers teach, and then there are others who don't want to get near teaching. And you are a teacher. You call yourself a teacher. I remember David Gessner penned a piece for the New York Times years ago where he kind of reframed that teaching saying, and the header was, those who write teach. Can you share a little bit about how teaching has been joyful for you, what it's given you?
I don't think I could imagine how I could have done my career without it, nor could I imagine going forward without teaching being at the heart of it. That there may be writers of literature who are simply sharing their muse.
Yeah.
But for me, this is always about what can I discover? How can I process what I discovered into a frame that others can get it more easily than I did? And then how can I share that frame in a way that others can teach others? Those three pieces all matter a lot to me. Mm. And I started as a teacher in 1977, and I've taught canoeing and juggling and computer science. I've taught business and life learning and other things. And it's always the same. It's not different based on the genre. And that feeling of helping people become incompetent, because that's what we are just before we're good at something.
Right.
That's the only hard part about learning, is the incompetent part. And I love the craft of it. And mostly, I love enrollment. And that's why I love to speak. And that's how I can tell in less than 10 seconds if the speech I'm going to give, it's going to be one of the best ones or one of the worst ones. It's not
really,
because I can give it the same way if I want to.
Right.
It's the audience and whether they are enrolled or not. And to show up with students who are eagerly seeking to go where you can take them is such a vivid example of trust. And it's one that I'm not willing to violate. It's one where I will do whatever I need to help them go to that level. I mean, I used to do 9-hour Q&A sessions with groups. I would rent a theater somewhere and 200 or 300 or 400 people would come. And I would commit to outlasting the audience. And I would. And I would be unconscious for 2 weeks afterward.
I was going to say, you can't even talk after that.
Okay, Seth, this is our rapid fire round. Are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready to go.
Okay, great. Power walk or power nap?
I made a rule, no napping in 1986, and I haven't broken it.
What? Never?
Unless I'm sick.
Wow.
Okay. Tea or sympathy?
Herbal. Thank you very much.
Good. Okay, for pleasure reading, hard copy, soft copy, or ebook?
All three, usually trashy fiction.
Yeah. Oh, I love trashy fiction. Kermit or Miss Piggy?
I don't like either one of them at all.
Really?
Yeah. I'm a little too old for the Muppets, I guess. I don't know.
Okay. All right. Uncharmed by Muppets. I'm ready. Paris or Tokyo?
I love Tokyo, but the time zone is a problem. But Tokyo, it's just, yeah. But Paris, my friend Apollonia runs Belen Bakery. But there's too much butter in Paris, so Tokyo.
That's why we love Paris.
I always like how Paris doesn't need you to love it. Paris is like, we know, we're fabulous.
Well, exactly.
TED stage or primetime TV?
TED.
Gershwin or Lloyd Webber?
Gershwin. That's easy. Nice. Has anyone pick Lloyd Webber?
It was kind of a trick question, I mean.
Okay, I so have to do a couple follow-ups. Okay, why no napping?
Because I worked by myself at home for many years, and I was failing and failing. And when you're failing and you're working by yourself at home, the easiest way to escape is to take a nap.
Oh, God, I'm so glad I asked. That's so true, isn't it? I only stopped napping when my fiance made me a time tracker and showed me how much damn time I was wasting. And so I did stop. Unless I'm really, really hitting the wall, like maybe I've been up all night with a sick puppy or something, you know, now occasionally, but I'll set an alarm for 20 minutes. Okay. And then Ted, you answered that one so quickly.
Well, the problem with primetime television is it demands mediocrity. Mediocrity in the sense of average stuff for average people.
Yeah.
Because primetime TV is based on 1/3 of the audience is a tie. You need more than that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I haven't given a TED Talk in a while, but I have given 5 of them.
And they're so good.
3 on the main stage. And the TED phenomenon has become a different version of itself. But yeah. The idea that you would like to teach something in a non-interactive way in just 18 minutes that might stand the test of time.
Yeah.
And that you don't get too many tools or gimmicks to use along the way. That's a really cool... That's not as big an idea as trading fours in a jazz quartet, but it's close. And I'm not crazy about the memorized, highly processed TED Talk.
Yeah.
Back in the day when Ricky was running it and it was smaller, we didn't know that anyone was even going to be
right
on video. So when you get a glimpse inside the, I don't use the word authentic here, though I don't mean to, the authentic ramblings of a teacher who cares, it's magnetic because of its humanity. My belief is presentations are not about exchanging information because they're very inefficient at that. You're better off giving someone 2 pages of bullet points. Presentations are about the exchange of emotion. To say, I care enough about this idea that I will stand up here virtually naked to share it with you. And that's why we need to.
Oh, beautiful. All right. We're going to wrap this up, but I want to get woo-woo for a second. Samantha knows this about me. I think I may be inclined to look for magic a little more than the average bear in my work. And certainly more when I was starting out than now. But I also know I am in no way alone in my predilection to look for otherworldly confirmation. Can you name a time when you received any kind of seemingly mystical sign from nature, a dream, your muse, something that came in and really helped you with your work?
So there are stories told of the greatest magician no one ever heard of. And his name is something like Mylene, the great Mylene. And he was at a state dinner in Europe in the 1800s. And everyone saw him walk in and everyone saw him sit down. And someone sitting next to him said, "What do you do?" And he said, "I'm a magician." They said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, what would you like to see?" And they said, "I don't know, produce a turkey." And he did. He did. He put a napkin on his plate, waved around, and there was a full-sized turkey. Now, the thing about magic is if I tell you how it's done, it's not magic anymore. Mm. And what makes it magic is we don't know. Mm. And there are lots of things around us that we don't understand, but we don't think of them as magic, like electricity, because it doesn't feel like it was special in that moment.
Yeah.
When something we need to happen happens in a moment when we need it to happen, it gives us pleasure to imagine that it was magic. Mm. So what I have tried to do with my work is strip away any place I have to hide so that time is not variable. I have to post every day so that my audience isn't variable. I know who it's for. And then I'm not waiting for the great Mylene to bring a turkey. Right? Now what I'm trying to do is do this work because I get to. What a privilege.
Yeah.
So it is entirely possible that things that felt magical have occurred right when I needed them to, but I refuse to call them magic because I don't want to find myself waiting for the next one.
Oh, I like that. I like that a lot. Samantha, what about you? Any crazy situation come in and just shock the shit out of you?
Oh, I'm shocked constantly. Shocked that anything happens. Yeah, and you know, I am one of those people who kind of thinks that everything is magic, which I understand is the same as believing that nothing is magic. And
sure.
I'm okay with that. I do kind of lean into it more on my side, though. Like we were talking before about those quote-unquote authentic emails or the really heartfelt ones. Before I send any email, I stop and I pray over it. Like I take a minute and I really sort of check in with whatever there is to check in with, you know, with my own inner wisdom, with the vibe, with the energy, with the magic, and to say, you know, is this really the right thing to send to these people at this time? And I just sort of try and bless it that it gets received and heard by the people who want to receive it and hear it. And God bless the unsubscribes and, you know, and that makes me feel good. I do it mostly so that I feel good. It does. And every once in a while, I'll get a little like, nope, don't do it. You know, it's not the right time, or that thing you think is so funny is not that good of a joke. Somebody's going to take it the wrong way, rewrite, you know.
That's so funny. When you just said every once in a while, you'll get that, don't do it. I had some friends years ago and they were therapists, PhDs, a man and a wife, and they used to take people up to Machu Picchu tours, like about 20 people at a time. And they told me this story. They came back from one of their tours and they said, you know, we told the group that you really got to ask the grandmother and the grandfather mountains if it's okay to climb them. You know, you just don't go traipsing up those sacred mountains. So they asked the group and everybody needed to check in with themselves. And most of the women heard not to go. And most of the men, all of the men said, no, it's fine. Oh, I'm going. And half of the men got sick. I don't know why I told you that, but that always left an impression.
All right. Seth, I have a question about what I think is maybe the dirty little secret of solopreneurs and entrepreneurs and creative people, which is debt.
Sure.
That when you are bootstrapping, you know, when you are in the position of, you know, this work is buying my groceries. Almost every entrepreneur I know has accumulated at some time or another, somewhere between $25,000 and, I don't know, $250,000 worth of debt. You know, big businesses get loans or don't need to show a profit. Small businesses use credit cards. And I never got the memo that debt was bad. I mean, I get that it's not favorable. You know, like that's something we want to seek out. It seems to me to be an expensive but fairly harmless thing. I don't know. What do you think about this?
I have a lot of strong feelings. What a surprise. Where are you going to draw the line? You got to draw the line somewhere. Mm-hmm. Is 20,000 too much? 200,000 too much? 2 million too much? So thanks. I begin here. I begin with realize you have to draw a line. Situational decision making about debt is foolish because it will only go in one direction and you'll put yourself into a super deep hole. Decide in advance and stick with it. Number two, the most important rule of debt for businesses and also for humans, you should go into debt to buy things that go up in value. That's why it's pretty easy for a bank to loan you money to buy a machine for your factory, because the machine will create value day after day after day after day. Uh-huh. It's not a wasting asset like celery or food for dinner, because once you eat it, it's gone forever.
Yeah.
So if you are borrowing money just to stay alive, you don't really understand what it is to be a bootstrapper. Rule number three is don't personally guarantee anything if you're a professional. If you can't get debt against your business, then please acknowledge that you don't have a business that is worthy of debt. That what you're doing instead is personally borrowing money, which means you are personally on the hook for years to come. So what should you do instead? Well, we run the Bootstrappers Workshop because I've been thinking about this for 20 years. What you do is you do work that your customers find so valuable, they pay you in advance. If you can't find customers who care enough about your work that they will pay you in advance, then you're probably not a bootstrapper. You're probably using personal debt to live a life until one day you make something that you get picked for, and then you get money. And I don't think that's the right way to professionally build your practice as a bootstrapper or even as a freelancer. Instead, we have to do the hard work of saying, who needs to be connected? Who needs a problem to be solved? Who is drowning? Because I'm wearing my lifeguard outfit, and I bet if I show up in front of the right people on the right day with the right trust and the right attention and offer to save them, they will happily throw me money.
I love that. And I love the challenge of thinking to myself, like, well, what could I do that would be that valuable? I have a friend who's a coach who had a $100,000 coaching program for a year. And I was like, I got to sit with that for a second. And I thought, what could I possibly offer someone that I would feel okay about them giving me $100,000 for? And I'm still not going to do it, but it was a really interesting question.
Or 100,000 people deciding that they should pay you
exactly.
So a simple example, there used to be this trade show called Mac World Expo. And there used to be 200 independent stores around the country that sold Mac stuff. Well, what I did was find the list of the 250 companies that were demoing new products at Mac World Expo. And I wrote them a letter. I said, look, I'm making a poster and it's going to be on the wall of every one of these 200 stores because their customers can't get to the show. And I've got 40 pictures on it. Do you want to have one of the 40 pictures on the poster? If your picture's on the poster, it'll get seen at these 200 stores for the next 4 weeks. And it's only, I don't remember what it was, $1,000. And so $40,000 came in and I paid the printer $20,000 to print and distribute the poster. And I made $20,000. That's what a bootstrapper does.
And that's a win-win-win-win-win-win-win.
So that just kind of ties into that. Can you talk about, I love this part of the book where you talk about why you think we should focus more on public relations than publicity.
Right. So publicity means getting in print. Publicity is, as long as they spell my name right, publicity is controversy or showing up someplace because you can. If you look in the New York Times, there used to be a column in which they described somebody's office. Right? Uh-huh. Well, that was just because the publicist couldn't get the company in for any other reason. And public relations is when we tell ourselves the story of what you do, what do we say? Right? Public relations is what Regis McKenna did for Apple Computer. So Regis got all this credit for getting Steve on the cover of 17 magazines in 1 month. But that, he was ashamed of that. That wasn't what he really did. What he really did was he helped Jobs and Woz see that what they were actually selling was a lifestyle and the future, not a bunch of chips in a box. Mm-hmm. And that act of public relations is often called marketing because they're on a continuum. But most of the charities I work with, most of the people I know who are struggling because the thing they make isn't that good, or because they're public relations, the way they tell their story to who they tell it to is all twisted around. And getting that part right is 100 times more valuable than publicity.
Nice.
So more and more getting traditionally published or even successfully self-published relies more and more and more on having a platform. But as we started out talking about, so many writers are marketing phobic. We've talked a lot about storytelling and lifeguarding and teaching. Any other thoughts to help them to change their mindset or any practical steps they can, so they can sort of get the experience of it and go, oh, that works, and have it be fun?
Yeah, just stop waiting to get picked. You're waiting to get picked because you're afraid. And you should publish on the Kindle every month, even if it's a short story. And you should blog every day, even if it's just a haiku. Because if you get into the practice of picking yourself, then you have good taste as an editor and you will rise to the occasion. But if you're trying to get a struggling book publisher who's going to sell to a struggling bookstore to put your anonymous book in front of masses of people who aren't going to look at it anyway because you want to say, I got picked and look at this blurb, I don't think that's the work you ought to be doing.
Yeah. And that's the magic of it too, isn't it? Like you let it out of the house and things happen.
Yeah.
Or they, or don't. They don't. And then you know. Either way, you'll become a better writer.
What a delight, Seth. Thank you so much.
You guys are great. You're so great. This was a highlight of my day. Thank you.
To quote you at the end of your book, I cannot wait to see what you build next. Love, love, love you too.
Thanks.
You're great. Thank you both. Big hugs.
Hi, Sam Bennett here from the Organized Artist Company, and I just wanted to jump in here to elaborate a little bit on something. So, you know that book of mine that Seth so generously endorsed? Well, he only looked at it because I had a publisher. And the only reason I had a publisher was that I wrote a kick-ass book proposal, and the only reason that I had a good book proposal was because I had Linda and Danielle's amazing template called Your Big Beautiful Book Plan. Your Big Beautiful Book Plan has so much great information. It holds your hand and it tells you step by step what you need to do and what you don't need to do. It's really friendly. It's filled with super cool real life examples. And truly, I was a total newbie nobody who didn't even have an agent. And the first editor I submitted it to gave me a deal. And guess what? I'm currently working on the proposal for my latest book. And guess what I have open right now to help me figure out what's what? Your Big Beautiful Book Plan. Yep, it's that good.
Oh my God, you guys. Okay, I'm cutting Sam off in this incredibly generous and spontaneous commercial she just emailed me. But to find out more, go to yourbigbeautifulbookplan.com. I know you're going to want to follow Sam at this point. She is seriously addictive. Find her universe over at theorganizedartistcompany.com and or join us over at thebeautifulwritersgroup.com where you can connect with Sam and me in our private Facebook group and every month in our writing and publishing Q&As. For Seth, Lord, if you're not already a subscriber, you're going to love his daily blog. Each post is short and sweet and profound. It's the first thing I read every day. Sign up at sethsblog.com. And be sure and download or buy his book, This is Marketing, because I know you want to make things better by making better things. Lastly, thank you for your kind words and 5 stars over on iTunes. It really does help spread the word about our little show and help people find us. Much love, everyone. Write on.